Turn in your Bibles, please, to the book of Esther, chapter 1. Esther, chapter 1. Our preacher of the morning, Dr. Dan Olinger, who's chairman of the Division of Bible, has asked that we read the first 12 verses of Esther 1. Now, it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 provinces, that in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even 84 days. And when these days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan the palace, both unto great and small, 7 days. In the court of the garden of the king's house, where were white, green, and blue hangings, fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rings and pillars of marble. The beds were of gold and silver upon a pavement of red and blue and white and black and marble. And they gave them drink in vessels of gold, the vessels being diverse one from another. And royal wine was in abundance according to the state of the king. And the drinking was according to the law, and no one did compel. For so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house, that they should do according to every man's pleasure. Also Vashti the queen made a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagtha, Zether, and Carcass, the 7 chamberlains that served in the presence of Ahasuerus the king, to bring Vashti the queen before the king with the crown royal, to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to look on. But the queen Vashti refused to come at the king's commandment by his chamberlains. Therefore was the king very wroth, and his anger burned in him. And the Lord will bless the reading and preaching of his word.
The Bible tells a story. It's a story of God calling out a people for his name. It begins with God creating people in his own image, and with that people multiplying as he had told them to do, turning into a great mass of people with different cultures and, by his design, different languages. And eventually, out of those peoples, God calls a man, Abram, out of Ur of the Chaldees, and says that he will make of him a great nation. And we begin to see God select, narrow the selection, and work his plan to redeem his people. 500 years after Abraham, he calls Moses out of Egypt, uniquely prepared in the household of Pharaoh, and calls him to take his people, now a great people, perhaps 2 million or so, out into the wilderness, and there he executes a covenant with them and makes them a nation, a political entity. And 500 years later, he calls David out of the sheepfold in the hills surrounding the little village of Bethlehem, and he raises him up to be a king. And he announces to David that his kingship will last forever. And all of this is part of this great story of God gathering a people for his name and rescuing them from their sin, sending them a redeemer and king. Shortly after David, under his grandson Rehoboam, the kingdom is divided and things begin to go very, very bad. Not that there haven't been indications of that before in the telling of the story, but things take a very dark turn, an unusually dark turn, under Rehoboam. And now we have 2 kingdoms and not one. And one of them is under kings who are not descended from David and not protected by the promise. And that northern kingdom of Israel, the northern 10 tribes, is a record of disaster after disaster, of people making their own gods and worshiping them. And God warns them for hundreds of years. And finally, about 300 years or a little less after David, as God has warned, the northern kingdom of Israel goes into captivity in Assyria, and they never return from that captivity. God warns the southern kingdom of Judah that the same will happen to them if they don't turn from imitating Israel by worshiping her false gods. And 150 years later, true to his promise, God calls the Babylonians to take the southern kingdom of Israel into captivity. For what Jeremiah says will be a 70-year captivity. I don't have time to talk about that this morning, but Jeremiah is actually right twice with that one prophecy. There are two spans of 70 years in that captivity. And after 70 years after the first deportation, just short of 70 years after that first deportation, Babylon is conquered. We read about that in the book of Daniel, in the handwriting on the wall incident. The Persian kingdom comes in by night and conquers Babylon, and the leader of the Persians is named Cyrus. He has been named more than 200 years before by Isaiah the prophet as the one who would rescue his people as God's anointed, God's Messiah. And Cyrus is an enlightened ruler for his time. It occurs to him that people in a broad empire might be less likely to rebel if they were happy. That's a real breakthrough in governance theory in his day. And he says, look, all of the people in my empire who have been moved from their homelands to other places are free to return. And that includes, of course, the Jews who are in Babylon. And some of them begin to return, and there are three great stages of return. The first is almost immediately on the 70th anniversary of that first deportation. A group of Jews return under the grandson of the last king of Israel. The grandson's name is Zerubbabel. And you can read about that return in the first chapters of Ezra. It's during that return that the prophets Haggai and Zechariah minister, and you can read more about that situation and the erection of the altar there in the old temple site, and then eventually in Haggai 1, the rebuilding of the temple. About 60 years later, there's another return under Ezra, the priest, the ready scribe in the law of Moses. And under Ezra, the full Mosaic system of worship is reinstituted and reorganized. As it had been even under David and Solomon. And about 100 years after Ezra, there is another return, a much smaller return, under Nehemiah. And Nehemiah, as you know, leads the rebuilding of the walls. And God is being faithful in regathering his people to their land. But you know, relatively few Israelites returned in any of those three returns. The great majority of Jews stayed in Babylon. And it's understandable why they did so, because Babylon is home to them. It's been 70 years. Most of them were born in Babylon. And why should they go to another place that they've never been, and a place that is in ruins, by the way, where there's nothing, none of the conveniences of life, no organization, no government, no place to live, no infrastructure. So most of them stay in Babylon. And while Ezra and Nehemiah tell us the story of Israel in Palestine in these years, Esther, the book of Esther, tells us the story of the Jews back in Babylon, or technically now it's Persia, but it's the location of the old Babylonian kingdom. One commentator says, to say that the story of Esther is well told is an understatement. It's one of the most well-known stories in the Bible. When my daughters were small, it was their favorite story. I suppose because the hero is a woman. But also because of the way the story is told. It's filled with surprises, and we'll come back to that element later in the message. The title of my message this morning is Second King. Not Second Kings. Second King. And I'll have more to say about that as we proceed. When the book opens, we are in the year 483, which means, for those of you keeping track, we're between Zerubbabel's return, that first wave, and Ezra's return, the second wave. As I have already said, the Babylonian kingdom was overthrown by the Persians, by a ruler named Cyrus. He was later deposed and replaced by a pretender to the throne whose name is Darius. Darius ruled for many years. And then his son was named Xerxes. By the way, Darius's title was the Great, and so was Darius's, and so was Xerxes. So apparently these guys were all related. They all had the last name, the Great. They were well impressed with themselves, and that's going to be a major recurring theme this morning in the message. Xerxes, I've called him. Chapter 1 here calls him Ahasuerus. It doesn't look like it, but actually Ahasuerus is just another way of spelling Xerxes. I don't have time to explain that. The Persian name is Shayarsha, and the Greeks spelled it Xerxes, and the Hebrews spelled it Ahasuerosh, and we turned it into Ahasuerus. And so they're the same name, Xerxes, Ahasuerus. We know a lot about this man. Darius, his father, is Cyrus's successor. And Xerxes is described a lot in the writings of Herodotus. Now, that should ring a bell with you from History of Civ. Herodotus, you learned, was the father of history. Remember that? He wrote not long after Xerxes reigned. And since Xerxes is fairly fresh in his memory, he writes a lot about this man. We know that when he first came to power, about 3 years before this incident in chapter 1, there were revolts in the farthest reaches of his kingdom, in Egypt and in Babylon as well, which is relatively close. When there's a new king, there's a little instability. You want to test the guy, so some of his outlying provinces rebel to see if they can get free, and they were not successful. He and his armies went to those locations and crushed those rebellions, thereby establishing his power. After that victory over Egypt, he returns to his capital, and Herodotus tells us that he wants to plan an invasion of Greece. And the reason why is that, first, he wants to expand his empire. That's what emperors do. But his father, Darius, had led an attack on Greece and tried to conquer it and add it to the Persian Empire. Darius had been defeated in one of the most famous battles in history. It was on the plain of Marathon. And that was the battle after which the Greek soldier famously ran 26.2 miles back to Athens, reported that the Greeks had won, and then fell dead of exhaustion after delivering the message. And the reason we have little stickers on the windows of cars today that say 26.2 is because of that battle. Xerxes wants to crush, avenge his father for this defeat at Marathon. So he wants to invade it again. And so he gathers, Herodotus tells us, all of his officials from all over his kingdom to sell them on the idea of an invasion of Greece. That event parallels perfectly with the first few verses with the book of Esther. By the way, before we get to the story, I'd like to tell you a little bit more about Xerxes. When he went on this campaign against Greece, which is after the first few verses of this chapter, he built a bridge across the Hellespont, which is the body of water that separates Europe from Asia. He lined up a bunch of boats, roped them together, put planks down over the decks, poured dirt over the planks, and built himself a highway across the Hellespont. In one of those early attempts of that bridge, there was a storm that blew up and destroyed his bridge. And he ordered his soldiers to wade into the water and lash the Hellespont with their whips. That's the kind of king he was. He had a benefactor, a very wealthy man from the region of Lydia, whose name was Pythias. Pythias donated millions of dollars to the Persian treasuries to help fund this invasion of Greece. And he put his mouth where his money was. He put all five of his sons, into Xerxes' army. And as Xerxes was marching through Lydia on the way to Greece, this great benefactor, the one without whom Xerxes could not have mounted this campaign financially, asks for a meeting. And he takes him aside. He says, look, five of my sons are in your army. I'm an old man. I need help at home. Could I ask that you release my eldest son from the army so that he can stay with me and help me. And Xerxes' response with that was to have his soldiers, one of his soldiers, cut Pythias' son in half, place the two halves of his body on the side of the road, to both sides of the road, and march his army through. That's the kind of ruler Xerxes is. Xerxes' father Darius had begun a great palace in one of his capitals. Persepolis was the capital. That palace was completed by Xerxes. And the inscription on the foundation stone of that palace has been uncovered by archaeologists. And this is how it reads. I am Xerxes, the great king, the only king, the king of all countries which speak all kinds of languages, the king of this big and far-reaching earth, the son of King Darius, the Achaemenian, the Persian, the son of a Persian, an Aryan of Aryan descent. Reminds you of Ozymandias, doesn't it? Thus speaks King Xerxes, the inscription reads. These are the countries, in addition to Persia, over which I am king under the shadow of Ahura Mazda, over which I hold sway, which are bringing their tribute to me, and whatever is commanded them by me, that they do, and they abide by my laws. And then he goes on to name 26 nations that he has conquered. This is Darius. This is Ahasuerus. This is who we're dealing with in Esther chapter 1. In the passage that Dr. Short read for you this morning, we read that it's the third year of Xerxes' reign. So it's just before this Greek campaign. It's when he is gathering his officials to plan the military effort. We read that he's king from India to Ethiopia. India is defined here as the route of the Indus River. And that is today in modern Pakistan, but it's still far to the east of Persia. Ethiopia, in modern terms, is South Sudan, the new country of South Sudan, in the Upper Nile region, called Kush as well in biblical times. That's a big kingdom. He's in Shushan, the palace. Susa, or Shushan, is one of his four regional capitals. The other capitals are Babylon and Persepolis, where the big palace was, and Ecbatana, if you're interested. Susa was the winter palace, mostly because it was way too hot in the summer. It was the farthest south, and you just couldn't bear it in the summer. And so he would go there in the winter. He's in his palace complex, which is huge, where all the government officials and offices are, where there are living quarters for the king and for his harem and for his officials. And there are gardens, and it's a remarkable complex. And we're told in that paragraph that he has a feast. And it says that the feast lasted 180 days, 6 months. Now, it's a little unclear exactly how this worked. Here's my theory, and you can take it or leave it. I suspect that he began with a feast in celebration of the defeat of these revolts early in his reign. And after that feast, he called in the rulers from the various parts of the kingdom, and he's not going to call them all there at the same time. You don't want them to all leave the empire where they are, because then you get revolts. So he calls them in shifts, and he displays his power and his glory. And pulling all of these men in shifts takes about 6 months. And he wines them and he dines them and he intimidates them. And he says, now I'm going against Greece. Are you with me? Now, of course, he doesn't need their permission. He's the emperor. But it's good to have everybody on the same page, everybody with buy-in. And then we read in verse 5, after those days were expired, the king made, I think, another feast unto all the people that were in the palace. This is for the locals, the palace workers. And I suspect that what he's doing there is he's thanking the palace workers for the work they've done over the last 6 months, getting these people into town and feeding them and so on. And so this is to the palace staff, to the palace crowd. And the city residents are actually allowed to come into the palace complex and to see what kind of a king they have. We read that it's held in the courtyard, in the garden, verse 5. That palace has been excavated by archaeologists, and it contained a banquet hall with rows of marble pillars, and the seating area was roughly 60,000 square feet. And to help you with that, that's a little bit more than a football field. And it's under a roof, marble pillars holding that roof up. It's a huge expanse, a huge banquet hall. I don't know that there is any place today that is for that purpose. Our football stadiums, obviously, some of them are roofed, domed. But I don't know of a single banquet facility that would be that large. Perhaps I'm wrong. We read that there are beds. These are couches. They recline to eat at table, see? And these couches, we're told, are gold and silver. That doesn't sound very comfortable. Well, I suspect there were cushions on them. And either the couches themselves were made of gold and silver, or else they were upholstered with gold and silver cloth. Either one would be extravagant. And they drank from golden goblets, and some of those goblets have been excavated. And each one is a distinct work of art. They're all designed as unique pieces. The value of this wealth is just inestimable. And each guest is given complete freedom to drink as much as he wants. Well, you can imagine what happens. Verse 10. On the seventh day of the feast, the heart of the king, and I suspect of everybody else, is merry with wine. And so they're drunk. And one commentator says, when wine is in, wit is out. And Xerxes makes a demand. He says, get Vashti in here, the queen. I want to show her off. Now, we get some insight into the kind of man Xerxes is, and it is completely consistent with what we've already heard from Herodotus. Xerxes is a man who is full of himself, who is so given to promotion of himself that he abuses everybody around him. This is not a good guy. Now, I realize that what we're reading here is not the 21st century. This is a polygamous culture. The king has multiple wives. But one of them is designated the queen. She is his favorite. And she is worthy of special respect, as, frankly, all of his wives are worthy of respect, because they're his wives. And he treats her like an object and says, get in here and walk around so everybody can see how gorgeous you are and lust after you and wish they could have you, but they can't because you're mine. Oh, that's every woman's dream. It's dehumanizing. It's degrading. It's unforgivable. Now, this is how Xerxes uses the people who are closest to him. How is he going to treat his subjects? What kind of a king is this? For all the greatness, for all the wealth, for all the pomp and all the glory, he's really a very bad king. And he is not worthy of respect. Now, why did she refuse? Well, I don't know why people even bother to ask the question, but commentators really get into some arguments about this. Why did Vashti refuse? Some have noted that just appearing before a drunken mob is beneath her dignity. That's Herodotus' view, by the way. We know from the timeline that Artaxerxes is born that year. Artaxerxes is Xerxes' son and the next king of Persia. He's born that same year. She may well have been visibly pregnant at the time. And that would have been all the more discomforting to her. Some suggest, the Jewish Talmud suggests that it was modesty. I hope so. In any case, we find that the ruler of all the world, from India to Ethiopia, can't control his own house. And not only is he a bad king, he's also not a very good king. He's not very effective. So, verse 13. The king calls his wise men, his council of seven. All the Persian rulers had a council of seven advisors. And they're called into the king. And the king says, what should I do about this? And the advisors answer in a way that looks like it's in the best interests of the kingdom, but they're really thinking only of themselves. They say, verse 17, this deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all women. But verse 18 is what they're really getting at. Likewise shall the ladies of Persia and Media. Who's that? That's the nobles' wives. Okay. Xerxes, you not only messed up your own house, you not only got issues in your own house, you made life tougher for us as well. And we're not going to stand for it. Now, that's not how they say it. It's all very court language and very obsequious. But they're acting in their own best interest, too. They're following the example of their king. And now the king finds that because he's a selfish creep, he is surrounded by advisors who are selfish creeps. And that's going to taint the quality of their advice. And he's going to reap what he has sown. So they render their decision, verses 19 and 20. If it please the king, let there go a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes that it be not altered, that Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal estate to another that is better than she. And when the king's decree which he shall make shall be published throughout all his empire, for it is great, all the wives, including ours, shall give to their husbands honor, both to great and small. Now, this is Memucan, one of his seven advisors. And it's a brilliant piece of advice from a court perspective, because it gives the king a way to act in his own self-interest without appearing to do so. And it's obviously going to play well among the council of advisors, who are all men. Oh, yeah, that sounds like a good idea to us. Yeah, we'll put them in their place. Yeah. Under control. It's very interesting that they say, let it be a law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be changed. And yet it is put into place absolutely capriciously by a monarch who's drunk. So, where do we go? The decree is issued. Verse 21. The saying pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to the word of Memucan. For he sent letters unto all the king's provinces, into every province according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, that every man should bear rule in his own house, and that it should be published according to the language of every people. So now he's going to protect the interests of the noble class. The men are going to be the lords, and the wives and the children are going to be the subjects. Now, a casual reading could lead you to believe that that's the biblical picture. Wives are, after all, to be submissive to their husbands. But this is language, and this is a use of force that is all out of order with the biblical picture. This is not loving headship. This is not servant leadership. This is not mutual submission that Ephesians 5 talks about. This is a feudal system. It's also, as we're going to see, a futile system. It's not the biblical model. And I observe that it is a model that continues to this very day across much of the Middle East. The subjugation of women and their use for the mere pleasure of the men. That is not a biblical picture. Now, he distributes the decree to all of his kingdom. Herodotus tells us, at some lengthy description of the postal system that the Persians had, they had a pony express. They used relays of horses and riders. You could send a message from Susa to Sardis, which is way out in Turkey, 1,200 miles away, in less than a week. And in the days of instant messaging, that doesn't sound very impressive, but in those days, it indeed was. So, this is the Xerxes we have to deal with. And now we come to the event that is going to set up the rest of this very familiar story. Chapter 2 and verse 1 occurs 4 years after chapter 1. During those 4 years, after the deposition of Vashti, Xerxes engages in that campaign against Greece. He lashes the Hellespont. He bridges the Hellespont. He later throws a golden cup into the Hellespont to try and placate the gods. He marches against Greece. His navy moves in. His army moves in. His foot soldiers defeat the Spartan elites at the pass in Thermopylae in that famous battle where the 300 Spartans held off the Persian army for a few days in order to give Athens time. And eventually, in that campaign, he is defeated decisively by the Greek navy at Salamis, which is the water right in front of the city of Athens. And he returns to Susa and his kingdom in defeat, licking his wounds. And Herodotus tells us that at that time he licked his wounds, in effect. He comforted himself by turning greater attention to his harem. And so, in a perfect correspondence with the secular account, we find in Esther chapter 2 that he decides it's time to replace Vashti. He's home again, and he's wanting to divert his attention from his recent defeat. And so he calls a council again, verses 1 through 4. And his seven counselors advise him something they know will sell in the court. And that is, look, tradition is you usually take your wives from the families of the seven counselors. That's the tradition that Herodotus tells us about. Don't do that this time. Don't elevate simply somebody who's already in your harem to the position of queen. Let's find you a new girl. And to this depraved and self-centered king, that makes perfect sense. And they said, better than that, we'll get all of the most beautiful women in the kingdom, and we'll place them in your harem. And you will try each of them out. And the one that has the best tryout, you can elevate to queen. Oh, there is a basis for personnel policy. There is a reason to put someone in a position of honor and power and influence. Xerxes is a child. And he goes for, oh, sounds great. So the provincial overseers go to all the far reaches of the kingdom, and they gather all the beautiful women. And lest you think, this is the way we tell the story to our children, particularly our daughters, this is not just a beauty contest. These women are pulled from their homes without any choice in the matter, taken away from their families and their loved ones. They are brought to the capital. They are placed into the harem. And they are then prepared for a year for a one-night sexual tryout with a man they have never met and don't know. And if they don't perform up to his standards in that one tryout, they are returned to the harem where they live a life of celibacy and separation from society. They're never allowed out. They're under the care of eunuchs who won't be any trouble. They live as nuns for the rest of their lives. They're throwaways. That's the kind of king Xerxes is. This is not a... Well, it would be viewed in the kingdom as an honor, but it would be hard for them to see it that way. He uses people for his own pleasure, and then he throws them away, and he doesn't care what happens to them. This is the kind of king Xerxes is. We meet a couple of characters here. Mordecai, who's a palace official. There is a historical record of a man named Marduka, who is one of the lead accountants in the Persian Empire, and he actually conducts an audit of one of the empire capitals during this time. This may well be that Mordecai. So accountants are cooler than a lot of people think. We also meet Esther. Her name is Persian for star. It's the root of the Greek astro, aster, our root astro. In Hebrew, her name is Hadassah, which means the myrtle tree or the myrtle flower. She is brought into the harem because she's gorgeous. And the harem official, one of the eunuchs named Higgai, recognizes her as of world-class beauty. And so he gives her several advantages. He puts her on special cosmetics, special diet. He gives her a staff of assistants to help her with her preparations. And special apartments, special accommodations, maybe a special rank in the harem, we're not sure. Esther is apparently not an observant Jew, and this is where the story, as you've been told it, I think is inaccurate. There's no indication here that Esther is particularly godly, and I realize I'm being a little controversial by saying this. The law forbids her to marry a pagan. Now, I realize she didn't have a choice, but Daniel didn't have a choice either, and he took a stand and was willing to lose his life for that stand. She apparently eats anything that's set before her in verse 9 of chapter 2. The Daniel's three friends won't do that. I don't want to be hard on Esther. I don't want to tear down a heroine, but I'm just observing from the data that there's no indication that she's a particularly close follower of Jehovah. And that plays a role in the conclusion we're going to make in just a couple of minutes. There is this trial, verses 12 through 14, 6 months of beauty treatments with myrrh, and I think 6 more months of beauty treatments with spices. One commentator writes, certain cosmetic incense burners have been found. Women of the Persian period saturated their hair and skin pores with pleasant odors from these burners. After 12 months of training, preparation, she gets that one-night tryout with the king. And she is then a concubine and returned to the harem. And if the king never calls for her again, she is thrown away as a momentary pleasure. Esther wins the contest. And she is promoted to be queen. She wins it without any special jewelry other than what the eunuch advises, without any special clothing other than what the eunuch advises. And as I say, she wins the contest. It's worth asking a question. Did Esther do the right thing here? In spite of all I've said to this point, I'm not going to be very hard on Esther. In fact, by being called to the king, she is his wife. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with sexual behavior between husbands and wives. And there's nothing that we should be prudish about in this instance. Polygamy was common in her day, and godly men did it as well, and there's nothing particularly unusual about that. It appears that she took her providential placement seriously and did what was expected of her, and I find nothing to fault in anything she did. But that's not really the point of the passage. Because, as I've said, the title of my message is 2 Kings. Esther is not the hero of this book, nor is Mordecai, nor is Xerxes, even though he is the king and a powerful one at that. The fact is that there's another king ruling in Susa, and he's far greater than Xerxes. And unlike Xerxes, he's not selfish, or he's not arbitrary, and he's certainly not inattentive as to his decrees. He loves his people, and he cares for them, and he keeps his promises. His people aren't in the promised land, but see, it's not Canaan that's magic. It's the God who has chosen Canaan for his people, who is powerful and active. And no matter where his people are, and whether they have returned when they could have or not, whether they are eating kosher or not, whether they're following the law or not, even if what Esther did was wrong in some ways, God still cares for his people and keeps his promises to them. His pleasure in His people is not the result of their good behavior. And what are we finding here in the book of Esther? We're finding the gospel. God is the real king of Susa and everywhere else. He cares for His people, whether they are in the place of promise and even whether or not they live up to their obligations. This is a story. You know the rest of the story. We don't have time to tell it. I'm about done. This is a story with many surprises. Xerxes is going to be unable to sleep. That's the theme verse of the book. Did you know that? 6:1. On that night, the king could not sleep. That's the climax of the book. And because he's unable to sleep, he's going to learn that Mordecai has saved his life and hasn't been rewarded. That's a surprise. Haman is going to learn that his plan to exterminate the people of his enemy Mordecai amounts to a direct threat on the life of the queen. That's a surprise. Xerxes is going to learn that Haman, his trusted advisor, is self-interested and not very bright and frankly bumbling. And Haman is going to learn that the gallows, the spike that he has erected for the execution of Mordecai, is going to be the instrument of his own death. But the greatest surprise of all in this book is that the great king, the king who's greater than Susa, the real king, the only king, is perfectly silent. His name is never mentioned in this book. But if you think he's not there, you're not paying attention. God keeps his covenant even when you can't see him. Behold, he who keeps Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. We live in a day when God has been silent for many years. And we're tempted to think that maybe he's not there, or maybe he's not faithful, or maybe he doesn't care, or maybe he doesn't know. But the fact is, he is alive, and he is here, and he is active. And he is actively securing your present and your future invisibly. That's how powerful he is. And you can trust him. Just as he kept his promises in those days, just as he brought from the loins of David a Messiah and King who will reign forever on David's throne and who redeemed his people, and before whom all those nations from India to Ethiopia will bow and exalt the name of Jesus, as our choir sang to us this morning. At the name of Jesus, every knee shall bow. Just as he has kept those promises, he will keep his promises to us. Silently, powerfully, certainly. Let's pray. Father, we speak to you aloud. You don't speak to us aloud. You speak to us on the pages of your word, and we're grateful for that because they're permanent, much more permanent than a voice from heaven would be. And we speak to you aloud because we trust what we read in your word, that even though you are silent, you are still here, and you are still attentive, and you still love us, and you still work in our behalf. And every day, the circumstances of our lives are evidence of the truth of our trust. Father, would you help us today and this week and in all the days you give us to hear the voice and see the hand of our silent, invisible God. We ask in the name of your Son, the great living proof that you keep your promises, Jesus Christ. Amen.